This is Mark Strassman, reporter for Utopia Media's Broadband Wireless Access World. We're about to speak to Greg Richardson, who's the CEO and president of Civitium. He's in Philadelphia. I'm in Studio City in Los Angeles, California. Welcome back to Utopia Media's Broadband Wireless Access World.
Thanks, Mark.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the path you took to become president and CEO of Civitium and where the company came from and what its main functions are?
Sure. Well, Mark, I was previously at Siemens here in the U.S. I had responsibility for their wireless consulting practice. Was involved in a project, one of the early municipal broadband consulting studies for a community called Houston County, which we profiled about a year or so ago with you.
Right.
And started Civitium as a management and technology consulting firm back in the summer of 2004.
Okay, and what's its mission?
Well, our core focus is on what we refer to as strategies for digital cities, which is really any community where technology is applied to promote economic development, social enhancement, and more efficiency in government. And wireless broadband is sort of positioned, in our view, as the foundation for that.
Okay, without getting too personal, tell us a little bit about your motivation in getting involved in this kind of work, which involves both technology and government. What was your sort of personal interest in pursuing these lines of activity?
Well, you know, I'd like to say that it was a grand strategy, but I think it developed as a result of some synergies. My business partner, one of my business partners with Civitium today is Matt Stone, who was at one time my customer. He was a councilman in Warner Robins, Georgia, where we did the Houston County study. And he and I last summer started talking about the impact of the work we were doing there and what we felt like the opportunity would be from a consulting standpoint as this intersection between particularly local policy making and the view of broadband more as a utility than as a nice to have, and what opportunity might exist in the market if that scaled to particularly to larger cities, which is where our focus as a company has been. And of course, that trend has played out in some ways as we thought it would.
Okay, well, we're going to talk about that. It's been less than a year since the company was formed. But do you have any sort of preliminary observations on how both the technology that you work with and the governmental processes that you're involved with have evolved since then?
Well, yeah, on both the technology and the policy front, I guess I'll make just a quick observation. On the technology front, a year ago there was a lot of excitement about this technology WiMAX, which was the basis for the study we were looking at in Georgia. Over the past year, I think many people, including us, were surprised at how fast the developments around metro-scale Wi-Fi technology developed. And I think from a technology standpoint, that's been one of the really important things that have happened over the past year. Vendors that no one had ever heard of came out of the blue with great products and made great traction, particularly in the public sector, on the metro-scale Wi-Fi and mesh front. From a policy standpoint, you know, we have this view that policymaking, like technology, is becoming more decentralized. And what I mean by that is that in the past, let's say the first generation of broadband, FCC policy, the 96 Telecom Act, Congress, and so on, the federal policymaking was really what shaped the industry. Our view is in terms of policy now is that, again, just like technology, policymaking is moving closer to the edge, and meaning that the actions of local governments, particularly in major cities, but really having started in rural and mid-America, is having what we think is a profound impact on the shape of the telecom industry. And so those are sort of two quick observations that we've made over the past year.
Okay, and without getting too far afield into the political part of it, is there a possibility that the politics will follow the technology in that the deployment of Wi-Fi networks on a municipal level will bring more power to municipalities vis-a-vis, say, the federal level?
I think so. I think the way I would describe that is that their Wi-Fi technology and generally speaking, wireless technologies operating in unlicensed spectrum have really resulted in a lower barrier to entry, whether that be a barrier to entry for a municipal government who may feel underserved or may feel that broadband facilities are not exactly meeting their needs from the private sector. And so I think that... That issue is really important in the whole debate, but I look at it more from the standpoint of lower barriers to entry. Those same lower barriers, of course, we believe are benefiting and will continue to benefit the private wireless ISPs, or the WISPs, who in the past had made great traction in the market and delivered a lot of value through dial-up services, but had really become stalled as they tried to make the transition to bringing subscribers onto broadband service.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in the context of an interview I did yesterday in a second, but just to take that a little further, the possibility even exists that if this movement to municipal broadband is successful and it helps city governments become more effective and small businesses and ISPs in cities and citizens in cities, there could be an entire resurgence of a more municipally focused government hierarchy that would bring better financial stability and more autonomy to cities, powered by this deployment of good broadband technology.
I do agree. I think I wouldn't take the argument so far as to suggest that federal policymaking becomes unneeded or unnecessary. I think there's always a requirement for sort of a macro policy view on broadband, but I think what's happening particularly as municipalities continue to frankly be the first movers and the innovators with respect to this technology scaling across a metropolitan area, I think it's adding a whole number of benefits to the market that wouldn't have been there otherwise. And one good example of that is, had municipal governments not been the first movers for metro-scale Wi-Fi and even the pre-WiMAX, so the proprietary solutions over the past few years, you know, my view is that the investment capital and the ability and the funding needed for vendors like Alvarian and Tropos and Bel Air and on wouldn't have existed.
So their interest is driving the whole market in a sense.
Well, I think they're playing a critical role. I think municipalities are playing a critical role because they're providing that early buying power.
Right.
For solutions that, frankly, I think there's a tremendous benefit to the market. More engineering time and more investment goes into that R&D.
In the way the Federal Space Program did for transistors.
Sure.
Okay, that's enough for the sort of general macro view. Let's talk about Philadelphia. What was the origin of the Philadelphia Wi-Fi project, and how did Civitium get involved, and what's been your role there in Philadelphia so far?
Well, I think that we became involved in September of 2004. That was several months after Mayor Street had announced Wireless Philadelphia and had launched the committee. Our involvement started in the September time frame and was initially focused on providing some advisory services to the committee that had been formed, really helping them focus on the issues that the committee would address in the report. Helping them collect data and analyze that data to improve the decision-making process that the committee was working on. And then ultimately, we worked with the committee to author the Wireless Philadelphia business plan, and then following that, the RFP that was released last week.
Okay, what did happen last week?
Well, last week was the formal launch of Wireless Philadelphia, which included really three key announcements from the city. The first was the announcement of the business plan, which stated the intent and the approach that the city was going to take moving forward. The second was the formation of Wireless Philadelphia as a nonprofit corporation to oversee the program. And the third was the release to the private sector of the RFP required for the project.
Let's take that just in turn. The first one is the business model.
Mm-hmm.
What is the business model for Wireless Philadelphia?
The business model for Wireless Philadelphia is what we refer to as cooperative wholesale. It's a public-private partnership.
What does the public do? What does the private sector do?
Sure. So there's a nonprofit organization that was created, and that's critically important in terms of understanding the business model. So the city formed a nonprofit corporation to oversee this program.
Is that corporation called Wireless Philadelphia?
That's correct.
Okay.
So that organization, Wireless Philadelphia, issues an RFP to design, deploy, and manage the network to the private sector. So the nonprofit really, in terms of their own staff and their own energies and headcount and so on, stays focused on overseeing the whole program and setting policy and trying to meet the objectives of both the nonprofit and the city.
Right.
So one idea here in terms of public-private cooperation is that the city doesn't, nor does the nonprofit, get in the business of really the ongoing day-to-day design, deployment, management of the network. The other side of the cooperative model in this scenario is that the nonprofit doesn't sell service directly into the market on a retail basis. The nonprofit contracts and provides a wholesale fee structure to internet service providers, other nonprofits, telecommunications providers, really anyone who wants to market service using the network that is owned by the nonprofit.
Okay, so the nonprofit's going to own the network. Mm-hmm. Who's going to design, deploy, build, maintain, and operate it?
Well, that would be the winning bidder from the RFP process.
So, okay.
We have the pre-proposal meeting that's happening this Monday, the 18th, and we expect to get a good gauge from that meeting. My sense, and I think the city's sense, is that it will be a very competitive process. We've seen a lot of interest in the RFP, so we're looking forward to that.
Okay, now, I think in the last session I had with Diana Neff, the CIO there, and one of the important people in this whole process, that consortia are going to form to bid on this RFP. Is that about how you see it as well?
I think that's fair. I don't think that, just my own opinion, I don't think that there are any companies in the market, even the very large organizations that you might think of, who have all of the components from both a product and service standpoint to deliver this. So in other municipal projects that we've seen, that has been the approach that has tended to develop. A large party steps forward, a large, credible, typically well-known organization steps forward as a prime bidder, and they assemble the best from their partnerships for equipment, various types of software, infrastructure, services, and so on. So that's not a requirement. Obviously, we welcome anybody to bid, but that's kind of what we've seen shape up in other cases.
And those consortia will essentially be general contractors to do the project.
That's correct. It would be, from the nonprofit's viewpoint, it would be outsourcing that design, deployment, and management to a consortia or to a bidder.
Okay, and that consortia or bidder or general contractor, one company, one organization is going to be selected to design, deploy, maintain and operate the network themselves, or will different companies possibly get contracts to do different parts of that process?
Well, I think that's really to be seen from the RFP process. I mean, obviously the nonprofit retains the right to, and the way we structured the RFP was to allow the nonprofit to make decisions about breaking up bids, choosing various components.
Right.
So I think that's really to be seen. We want to get to the next stage when we have the responses in hand.
Okay. So essentially, though, at this point, it's possible that one company could get the contract to design, deploy, maintain, and operate the system. Mm-hmm. But it's also possible that one company could get the contract to design and build it out, another one to maintain and operate it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair description.
Okay, but will any of those companies also be in the running to be an ISP, or is that a separate process on top of the physical infrastructure that will be built and maintained by one or more of these bidders?
That's a great question. The way the business model was developed assumed that the RFP process was completely separate and independent of negotiations that might happen between the nonprofit, i.e. the wholesaler, and other retail providers.
Right.
So we view that as a separate process. I think the question as to whether or not certain parties would bid on the RFP and also express interest and negotiate commitments to sell service on the network, I think that's also still to be seen.
Okay.
I would not be surprised if that were the case, because obviously some companies in the market are very good at designing, building, and managing large-scale wireless networks, and they also have a large presence in terms of subscriber acquisition.
Okay. Now, when this process is completed and the Wireless Philadelphia nonprofit now owns this Wi-Fi network, how are companies who want to provide service using it going to relate to the Wireless Philadelphia nonprofit?
Well, let me first clarify that we typically wouldn't describe the project as a Wi-Fi project. The requirements are defined in such a way that what we expect, and we left a lot of leeway for the experts, the vendors who respond to this, to propose a solution that they felt was appropriate. But the RFP calls for both Wi-Fi technology on the edge of the network and also some what I would describe as fixed wireless broadband solution in the middle,
right,
for backhaul service and higher-end tenant access.
Does the system involve backhaul by any means other than wireless?
Well, the assumption that we made, and again, the bidders are free to design in their RFP process and propose what they think is most cost-effective, but what we assumed in the RFP process based on the RF study and some of the testing done on the pilot networks was that approximately 60% of the backhaul requirements for the Wi-Fi tier of the network could be met by a fixed wireless broadband solution. That may come in very different. Vendors may, in their studies, may have a different view on that, but that was our assumption, and we felt that, generally speaking, it is more cost-effective to deploy a fixed wireless backhaul solution that you own than it is to incur leased line fees
right.
for backhaul.
So it's
it'll probably be a hybrid.
Okay.
I think that's the short answer.
For its part, the city of Philadelphia, is it making all of its facilities and lampposts and traffic lights and so on open and available to the Wireless Philadelphia nonprofit to use in deploying the Wi-Fi or the fixed backhaul?
Yes. The city in this business model would make those types of typically the structural assets, street lighting, other types of structures, as well as potentially other assets, which might include things like municipal fiber. But those assets would be made available to the nonprofit and, of course, then made available to support the network that the vendors ultimately deploy.
Okay. Now, go back to the wholesale cooperative model and how the ISPs come into this, whether they're big ones or small ones, whether they're local organizations or national or international corporations. How does the ISP structure fit on top of the physical infrastructure
sure.
that the Wireless Philadelphia organization will be owner of?
Well, there are a set of functions that we defined as being separated between the wholesale operator, i.e. the nonprofit, and the retail providers. The functions that the wholesaler provides are obviously ongoing management of the network, physical and logical network management. They would provide Tier 2 customer service and technical support, and by Tier 2 I mean they would take calls from the retail provider's call agents in situations where an issue needed to be escalated for resolution. The nonprofit would handle really only what we call wholesale settlement, meaning that there would be, of course, the issue of collecting fees from the retail providers.
Right.
And the nonprofit would also be focused on, over time, increasingly focused on program initiatives, things like getting PCs into the home of low-income residents, getting programs in place to support economically disadvantaged or startup businesses, and so on. On the retail side, the expectations are, on the ISP side, is that those providers would handle subscriber acquisition, marketing, retail billing, what I would describe as Tier 1 customer service and technical support. So they're the first line of defense for a subscriber that they provision onto the network. And they might also provide other value-added services that run over the network. So if they chose to launch a voice over IP offering, you know, something of that nature, manage VPN for business, those would be things that they'd cooperate with the wholesale provider, but it would really be up to them how they package and bundle services for their market.
Okay, I sort of see now what the division is. You mentioned voice over IP. There's also video over IP, and as you said, virtual private networks. Those would be functions performed by the ISPs.
Well, there may be municipal
or contracted
uses.
For.
Yeah, what we didn't talk about was the connection between the nonprofit and the city in terms of a provider.
Right.
The assumption in this business model is that the nonprofit would provide what we refer to as anchor tenant services to potentially lower the cost of other services that the city might use today.
Right.
So, for example, if you had T1 replacement that might be serviced by the middle tier of the network, you may have mobile data needs. For example, you have land surveyors or parking enforcement officers. You have a lot of things like that where there's a mobile data need.
Including fire, police, and emergency medical technicians?
Sure. It could include really any municipal service, and I think there's some additional opportunity for economic value to the city by being able to reduce those fees.
And in fact, the nonprofit is going to contract directly with the city to do that.
That's correct.
So the city essentially will be its own big ISP.
Well, they would, and that's an important, that's a very important point, because how do the divisions look between the city and the nonprofit with respect to those functions we talked about earlier, the assumption is that a municipal person who may need support, let's say on the network, would actually pick up the phone and call the help desk for the city.
Right.
So the city, again, looks very much like a retail provider on the ISP side. And should that call need to be escalated or should there be some issue that needs to be triaged, if you will, then the nonprofit's resources are available for that kind of call escalation.
Right. So essentially, city functions are performed by the city contracting on the wholesale model with the nonprofit, but non-government organizations and individuals work with their own ISPs, which then in turn have their relationship similarly with the nonprofit.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I think it's also important to point out that, you know, for many years there have been debates over open access to broadband facilities, been very hotly debated from the 96 Act through what's going on today with Brand X and the cable industry and on and on. Really what we're doing here is suggesting that there's an opportunity for an open access model that's voluntary, that doesn't have to be federally regulated to open it up. And we're also suggesting that the technologies that are available today, the economics have changed so dramatically with those technologies that they may, in fact, support a wholesale model with potentially very low rates that's viable and a model that would not necessarily have been viable with a much higher cost structure in years past.
Okay.
So I always use the dial-up example. The dial-up internet industry has operated for many years on essentially a voluntary wholesale model for modem access. Companies like Level 3 and others have essentially provided the infrastructure to support dial-up ISPs by managing those POPs, if you will, those modems. And so I think the opportunity with these new technologies at a lower cost structure is there to enable a model that may not have worked 5 years ago.
Okay, speaking of costs, is it possible at this point to say anything about what it's going to cost for an individual user to get broadband at what kind of rates, broadband speed rates and cost rates?
Well, you know, I think there's plenty of detail in the business plan that outlines what the expectations are there. It's probably more granular than you'd want to get into on this call, but I think
Right. Generally
speaking, what the city has said and what the nonprofit says is that we'd like to see broadband service at dial-up rates. So you can assume that tends to be, from a retail standpoint, in the $16 to $24 range.
Okay.
With a level of service that I would suggest would not necessarily be a high-end service with respect to DSL and cable alternatives, but I think it's a service that is appropriate for particularly low-income and disadvantaged new subscribers to the internet. I also think it's relevant for large populations of dial-up subscribers who, you know, really haven't seen the benefit to switch from dial-up.
Okay, what about small and large businesses, and maybe a little bit about universities? How do those organizations fit into this plan?
Well, I think there's a case to be made where universities could operate as a retail provider. They could aggregate access for their enrolled students.
And staff and faculty.
Sure, staff and faculty and so on. And I think there's certainly a great opportunity there. I'm sorry, what was the other group?
Small and large businesses.
Well, I think the small and large business issue is really going to be dependent on what retail providers step forward and express interest. My expectation would be that there are certain retail providers in the market who may look particularly at the middle tier of this network, the WiMAX tier, if you will,
right,
and view that as an opportunity to gain access to facilities that could be resold to business. But I think that's really, going to be dependent on which ISPs and which business models and which target markets they elect to pursue.
Okay, on the political level, is this a done deal? Is Mayor Street able to implement this by the stroke of a pen, or does the city council or other political entities in the city need to get involved before it can be implemented?
Well, probably a better question to the city. I feel a little out of my element to answer that. I think my understanding would be that council must be involved if there are city assets such as poles and things like that at some point being made available, but it's probably a better question to ask the city.
Okay, and who is going to decide who gets the contract to build the system?
Well, the Wireless Philadelphia nonprofit has been formed. The board members for that nonprofit would be in place, and it would be expected that their governance and their decision making would result in a winning bidder at some point being selected.
Okay,
that's the process that's underway.
Where do those board members come from? How do they get to that status?
Well, the initial board members, as I understand it, are mayor appointed, city appointed, and I believe the organization, the bylaws are actually available for download as well. But I believe the governance model is that the organization over time becomes self-governing. So those board members nominate future board members.
Okay. What's the timetable at this point for this whole process?
Well, we have a very aggressive timeline for the RFP. We have the pre-proposal conference this Monday, the 18th. We have a question period that ends on the 25th, 25th of this month.
Right.
We have, let me see, I'm looking on the wall, I apologize.
Right.
We have the 23rd of May is the date that has been set for respondents to the RFP to submit their proposals.
Right.
And we have a date set of July the 5th when Wireless Philadelphia selects the respondents to essentially a shortlist, if you will.
The day after Independence Day, another highlight of the Philadelphia calendar.
That's right, birthplace of freedom, Mark.
Right. Okay. And so after the, we'll see if the celebrations that the signer said would accompany the signing of the Declaration of Independence accompany the signing of the contract.
Bring your quill pen and your inkwell.
Right, exactly. We discussed that a little bit with Diane and I did. Say something about that. Philadelphia was the linchpin of the colonies for a while. It was the capital of the United States. Through Benjamin Franklin, it was the center both of political and scientific development. How is that legacy being carried forward, do you think, with Wireless Philadelphia?
Well, you know, I think that you can't ignore the irony in terms of the viewpoints in the industry that this technology is liberating in terms of the use of unlicensed spectrum and more affordable cost structures to get broadband deployed and how critical broadband is moving forward. So I'm not sure that, I'm not sure I'm the best person to comment on how that legacy applies.
Well, we're going to talk about it a little bit. What just came to my mind, I hope no one takes offense here, that the telcos and the cable companies are the George the Third of this scenario.
I tend to be a bit of a moderate in that whole discussion. I think that the private sector, particularly the incumbents, they have, needless to say, tremendous assets. They contribute in unbelievable ways in any community that they operate in, and I think that it's easy to criticize them because of the lobbying that's happened and maybe some of the lack of support for initiatives like this around the country. But at the same time, I think there's a tremendous opportunity there for those providers to get involved in this process.
How do you see that happening, or do you? Have you heard much from them? Verizon's the incumbent telco, and I guess they're... Comcast is the major cable provider in Philadelphia?
That's right.
What have they said, or what do you envision as their possible role in any of this?
Well, you know, I really can't comment on anything they've said that wasn't said publicly, but my view is I think there's a tremendous opportunity. I think those providers recognize that opportunity. I think as a large organization, it's always difficult to turn on a dime in terms of adopting a new technology, embracing it. They clearly, any organization that size has legacy issues to deal with. We're still just, despite what some of the things you see in the press and some of the movements and some of the criticisms on both sides, we're still pretty hopeful that at the end of the day, I suspect what's going to happen. I'll just sort of net it out. I suspect that someone in the large incumbent category is going to break ranks on this issue and wrap their arms around the opportunity that exists for cooperation with municipal broadband.
Right. What technical or administrative form do you think that could take if that happened?
Well, I'm not sure that it necessarily takes a sort of regulatory form or anything like that. I think it really just comes down to an action by one of those providers to step into a community that they're intimately involved in, or not.
Right.
And make a very sincere effort to embrace the project and admit that owning the facilities is not a litmus test for them being willing to cooperate. I think that's really the sticking point in many cases. today. And as soon as one of those breaks ranks, I think, you know, you see the game change a little bit.
I'm not sure I understand exactly how it would happen. You mean to become an ISP?
I could say in this model, because, you know, this cooperative wholesale model is just what Philly chose, and there are other approaches, and there probably will be other approaches taken by other major cities. But whatever cooperative model the city studies and believes is best, hopefully those large incumbents are involved in the process. They give their feedback. Hopefully they're doing it in a way that isn't just an attempt to be disruptive. And whatever model ends up being selected by the community, I think that the form it takes is that those providers step forward and say, hey, I'll give you an example, Mark. I am an incumbent, and I have a large portfolio of services. I sell lots of different things, broadband, phone, I don't know, video.
Right.
I look at this opportunity as an opportunity to bundle yet another service, and I would call it nomadic broadband.
Oh, I see.
Throughout
okay.
the city. I'll bundle that with the other services that I offer today, and to me, obviously not my decision, but to me, that seems like an opportunity that's worth studying and considering.
So that means the company, the telco or the cable company, who would become an ISP within the wholesale cooperative model and then offer that Wi-Fi service to its customers, as you said, as part of a bundle with the other services that they provide.
Sure, that's one option I would think that those kinds of companies could consider.
Okay. What about the idea of multiple ISPs in the same area? Do you envision that large, medium, small organizations and companies will become ISPs and that they will compete with each other in terms of price and in terms of applications made available to Philadelphia residents?
Yeah, I do expect that local ISPs, there are, just in Philadelphia's case, there are many.
Right.
They're sort of stuck in the dial-up era.
Right.
Regional ISPs and national ISPs, I would expect that all of them would view this as an opportunity.
And they'd all be able to offer service to any particular residence or business there.
Sure.
And compete, as I said, on price and
it's
features.
A level playing field, right? So the network is open to any party who stepped forward and agreed to provide service over the network. I think competition is inherent in the model. I mean, it was one of the drivers for this type of model. The city didn't want to get in the business of regulating broadband rates and, you know, exclusively handing assets to one provider and
right.
you know, building an agency to set the price of broadband, and that's really not, speaking of my opinion here, it's really not the appropriate role of local government. So this was a way to get the objectives met in terms of social, economic development, and reduced cost of government, and give the market what it needs to meet your needs, which is competition and innovation. Enable the market to do those things, and I think setting a wholesale rate wherever you set it, you'll have certain providers who let's say have more value-added services to sell over the network, who will discount the basic access at a lower and lower price. So other providers may choose to make their money on just basic access, and
right.
they would expect that their fees would be a bit higher.
So in fact, what you may have done here, what you're attempting to do, it seems, is square the circle in some ways. You're creating a community-based, community-aware, community-oriented program, but you're harnessing the effects of competition at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, allowing the factors that you know can happen in the market, competition and innovation, giving them what they need to thrive is sort of the way I'd look at it. And I also, you know, would stress, it doesn't get talked about a lot, but if you can imagine a year from now, if Philadelphia, at the size of Philadelphia, 135 square miles, was ubiquitously covered with these technologies, what better city in the nation for any, let's say, startup or innovative company who had ideas about, well, maybe there are new services in an environment like this that people haven't even thought of.
Right.
Maybe there are new services that could deliver value, new technologies that could be delivered. A lot of people are talking about voice over Wi-Fi and you know, those kinds of scenarios. You know, you may see Philadelphia as the first city in which those kinds of ideas can actually be validated and tested.
Right. So the whole
that's
city becomes
be a draw. I think that's going to be a draw to Philadelphia in terms of, you know, startups. You have no you have not too shabby university environment here. That's for sure, with, you know, University of Penn and Wharton and Temple and Drexel and so on. So I think it's really going to be a hotbed for innovation as a result of being one of the first large-scale cities to do this.
Okay. Now, here's a set of related questions, essentially the rollout beyond Philadelphia. Is Civitium moving on now? Do you have an ongoing role with this process? Are you moving on to other cities or both? Or what's happening with Civitium vis-a-vis Philadelphia now?
Well, it's sort of both. We have other clients, other municipal clients, and private sector clients, because again, we're trying to provide value to both, not just local governments, but also to private providers. And we're involved in this project throughout the life cycle of the RFP process. So it's a little bit of both.
Okay. Now, what about other cities? And what has been the impact from where you're sitting of what's happening in Philadelphia for, to be specific, Los Angeles, where I am, where there's a mayoral panel as well, but it's charged only with creating a vision statement, not an RFP, and other cities around the country. Is this starting to bloom everywhere? And if so, are people looking to Philadelphia? Are they looking in other directions? What's the national picture on this right now?
Well, yeah, I do think people are looking to Philadelphia because of as much exposure and as much leadership has been shown in the project. I would imagine that, and from our experience, sure, those cities are considering the plan, and I think in general there's a certain amount of respect for the work that has been done in Philadelphia, and I expect that there's some reuse in terms of things like the work that went into stakeholder analysis for Philly is relevant to many communities. The work that went into analyzing best practices in other communities, that's also relevant. So I think that that is a benefit. I wouldn't go so far as to say that the exact business model and approach would be a rubber stamp in every large city around the country. I think the needs of major cities vary greatly. Their climate, the economy of the local city, the leadership has different ideologies.
But there's a model of process that you've developed that can be transferred to
sure.
other cities that then get their own input in terms of community groups and economic goals for the city and so on. Those can be factored in on an individual basis.
Yeah, and I think from our standpoint, from Civitium's sort of selfish view, we feel that we've developed a certain framework to step through the decision-making process in any major city
right.
to analyze these issues. What is the appropriate role of government given my situation?
Right.
So, we're not, for example, trying to take the Philly model and replicate it all over the place. We're really more focused on the framework. How do I understand the different motivations that a city might have and the different characteristics of the city and the stakeholder needs? And then step through a variety of business model options
right.
to come to the right decision.
Your value added is in structuring that process,
right?
And then the cities provide their own content, essentially.
Yeah, it's not in the blueprint for cooperative wholesale.
Right. You're a platform provider, and they're a content provider in that
sure.
in that sense.
That's a great way to put it.
Is Civitium able to scale itself up? Are you getting more business than you can handle? What's happening in that regard?
Well, the phone rings a lot, yeah.
Okay.
So we feel pretty good about the experience and the way the market has responded to what we do and pretty excited about the future.
Okay. Speaking of the future then, do you see much in the much energy going to be spent by state legislatures and telcos and cable companies and cities in hashing out some of the issues that were raised by HB 30 in Philadelphia? Are the cable companies and the incumbent phone companies going to fight at the legislative level to prevent what's happening in Philadelphia from happening in other cities and states?
Well, it seems that they're certainly going to try, and I think the amount of legislation has certainly increased since the fall of last year. I don't see any sign of that slowing down.
Okay.
Some bills are getting struck down. Other bills are getting the language revised.
Right.
And obviously we're not attorneys, not trained in the law, so
right.
I can only look at that sort of anecdotally.
Okay, now, I did a video interview yesterday with Jim Pickrell, who's the president of Brand X, a company you mentioned earlier that's has a case pending in front of the Supreme Court now to talk about, to establish their right or lack of a right to provide their ISP services over cable networks. I wonder if you could address from your point of view, in a non-confrontational way, I'm sure, The threat, the problem, the situation involving the fact that if, for example, the Brand X case is decided in favor of the incumbent telephone and cable companies, Mr. Picarello essentially painted a picture in which people will have, essentially to paraphrase Henry Ford, he said you can get it in any color as long as it's black, you'll be able to get your internet connection in any flavor as long as it's either from the phone company or the cable company, and there'll be duopolies everywhere which will stifle innovation, raise prices, and generally stagnate the whole process. It was his point of view. That would leave municipal Wi-Fi as sort of the only alternative to this kind of duopoly. What do you see about that situation in Philadelphia and more generally?
Well, I can probably only comment on it more generally. I mean, we're advocates for open access to facilities on any side, but at the same time, we're also realistic about the fact that regulated open access from the 96 Act and what's going on now with this new movement for opening the cable facilities and everything else hasn't really been very effective. It's generally been perceived to be, for the most part, a failure. I think as a layman in that area, not a specialist in telecom law, but I look to certain people in the industry who I think are really the thought leaders about what's needed for reform in telecom law. And those are people like Mark Cooper with Consumer Federation.
And what kind of models or suggestions
well,
is he making?
Well, generally suggesting what's referred to as a layered model, to look at policymaking more in the way that engineers might look at layers of network architecture. And
right.
That being driven by convergence, because
right.
You know, as you move to converged networks, the old ideas about how you regulate it don't really work anymore. Kevin Werbach, in my opinion, from Supernova and from the University of Wharton Business School here in Philadelphia, those are the people that I sort of look to and take the lead in terms of telecom reform.
Well,
but again, I'm a layman in that debate, so I can only sort of look to the experts.
Well, are you sort of saying then that ISPs are not necessarily going to be able to succeed by offering their services over cable and phone networks, and therefore they ought to be looking towards a some sort of municipal broadband model that would provide an infrastructure that would be open to them to offer their ISP services?
Well, I think that, yeah. Okay, so that's an interesting issue. I probably could provide a little more commentary on it. My sense is that the ISPs, the ones that have traditionally been non-facilities based.
Right.
It's clear what their problem is. Large base of dial-up subs who migrate and their margins drop.
Right.
I think that's fairly well known.
And if they can't get into the phone company or cable networks, they can't follow their subscribers up to broadband.
Yeah, they can't follow them up to broadband. And if they do, for example, I'm a subscriber to a large national ISP, but I get my DSL at home from the local loop owner, the RBOC.
Right.
So I'm a great example of someone that they were able to retain and hold on to, but nonetheless, it's not exactly a very attractive situation in terms of margins. So I guess my feeling is that those ISPs must look at alternate broadband strategies, look at alternate networks. They may have to become more facilities-based. They may have to own
right.
Networks.
Well, in fact, they are. Mr. Picarello at BrandX was talking about that. So, in essence, say I was in the same position that he was, and facing the possibility of being shut out by the cable companies and the phone companies. If the cable telcos win the Supreme Court case, they're going to move either judicially or legislatively to establish the same right to exclude ISPs from the phone company plant. That would leave them out in the cold unless they then started organizing for municipal Wi-Fi as a platform that they could offer service through, because intrinsic to your model is an open network as opposed to an intrinsically closed network.
Right.
So.
Well, yeah, and I think looking at other technologies, not just municipal Wi-Fi, but WiMAX as well,
right.
is sort of critical. And I think those ISPs also have a large base of dial-up subscribers that have been overshot by the offerings that incumbents have brought to market.
Right.
In terms of, do I really need? Does the difference between moving from a 3 meg cable modem to an 8 meg cable modem, is that really the thing that's going to get anybody off dial-up? I don't
right.
think it is.
Right.
I think what they need is a basic, always-on broadband connection at a reasonable speed At an affordable price.
Right, and as you said, the plan in Philadelphia is essentially to provide broadband access at dial-up costs.
Sure, and I don't think anyone suggests that the qualities of service, the levels of service, if you will, on a network like this are going to be competing. They might compete on a price-adjusted basis with other alternatives, but they're certainly not going to compete on sheer performance.
Right.
With a wire into the home.
So people who want to watch high-definition television in all the rooms of their house still might want to have fiber optic from the phone company.
Oh, absolutely, or cable,
or cable.
Direct broadcast satellite.
Right.
And, you know, lots of different options there, but I think that people make trade-offs for a number of reasons when they buy a service. I think they make trade-offs for price. They make trade-offs for convenience. In this space, they make trade-offs for nomadic and portable use. I use this example. I pay three or four times as much for my cell phone on a monthly basis as I pay for my broadband at home.
Right.
Well, that says something. It's not about the speed of the connection on my cell phone. It's about the value prop that I need from it, which is that I can use it while I'm out and about.
Right.
But I think that's critical in terms of, you know, people who say, well, the community has DSL and cable. Why do they need Wi-Fi? Why do they need WiMAX? Well, DSL and cable are inherently incapable of supporting that kind of nomadic and portable use.
Either for business or personal use.
And it's not about speed.
Right.
It's about
convenience.
Usage model.
Okay. So say just a little bit about the how you cope with constantly evolving technologies and how the Philadelphia model is going to factor that in so that the best can be used, but when it becomes outmoded, it can be replaced.
Well, this was a big part of the issue in Philadelphia. It was something that the committee really focused a lot on. And the business plan that was developed called for something that we refer to as a working capital reserve. And the financial model basically assumed that the network financially, or this is not an operational issue about when it occurs, but from a finance standpoint, it needed to be replaced within a 5 to 7 year time frame, completely replaced.
Right.
And if you don't plan that in on the front end, then I think the criticisms about municipal and networks being obsolete and not being able to keep up with rapid advances, I think that probably would happen.
Right.
But in this case, we felt like from an operating standpoint, we covered things like spare inventory, maintenance, damage, theft,
right.
You know, those kinds of things. But we also built in an additional reserve. Now, the benefit in this kind of technology is when it's moving so fast, we can see a great deal of price erosion in the market for the same, just like you do in the PC space, for
right.
example. So to replace a network that you built in 2005, in 2010, you don't necessarily need the same capital. You typically need less.
Right.
So
because according to Moore's law, things get faster. As processing power doubles every 18 months, so does the efficiency of all the elements in the system that use it.
Sure.
Okay. I want to talk, if we can now, first about some sort of related issues here, particularly the digital divide, which is one of eliminating or reducing, which is one of the prime functions of the Wireless Philadelphia plan. In current thinking or current parlance, what's the essence of the digital divide? What is it exactly now?
Well, I think the delta that exists in opportunity afforded to those who have access to technology and those who don't, I mean,
okay.
that's sort of our working definition.
Right. And
that's social and economic, and it's a number of things, but broadly said, the delta in opportunity.
Okay, and here's a simple part of it. You're talking with Wireless Philadelphia about providing lower cost, better, faster internet connections, but you've got to have something to connect to take advantage of that. What's the picture within Wireless Philadelphia in terms of providing devices and training for that part of the society that is on the far side of the digital divide?
Well, I think that, you know, the committee in Philadelphia, very diverse committee, as you know, Mark, really brought, they frankly taught us as the consultants more than we taught them on this topic. And the thinking was that there were a number of things you had to attack if you really wanted to address the digital divide. You couldn't just throw any technology, whether it was a PC in the home or a cheap broadband or free broadband, and have that issue go away,
right.
be minimized. So the program in Philadelphia and really the thinking centered on four things that were needed. The first was PC in the home. We
right.
didn't believe that telling people Just go to the library. We have a cyber center. It's 2 miles down the road.
Right.
So you can go there if you want to use a PC.
You can't use it at 11 o'clock at night.
And it really doesn't have the impact. I've used the analogy, Mark. That's kind of like saying to people, we don't really need water coming into your home because there's a water fountain down in the park.
Right. Or you can go to the well in the town center. Right.
So that's kind of an outdated concept in terms of the cyber center model addressing digital divide. So PC in the home was important. Second thing was broadband, which we talked a lot about,
right.
At an affordable rate. The third thing was training and support, which is critical because many of these people, if they haven't had access to technology in the past, needless to say, there may be a literacy gap
right.
that needs to be addressed. And the fourth thing, which I think gets overlooked, is content.
Right.
There was a great case study here in Philadelphia that, frankly, was a windfall for us in terms of insight into this, and it was for the People's Emergency Center, a social service, a nonprofit organization who runs a homeless shelter in a part of West Philadelphia. The president of that organization, Gloria Gard, has developed a program that we felt it inspired us at Civitium. We wrote a case study on it. We had nothing to do with the project, but we felt like it was a story that needed to be told, and really inspired us in terms of putting all those four pieces together, taking high school students out of the local high schools and teaching them how to become certified in technology, then using those students to provide some of the support in the surrounding area. It's very much a community-focused, grassroots thing, but we looked at it and said, you know, that really can scale. If you put program elements around a spark like that, really put some process around it, institutionalize it, if you will, it really can scale.
So that
was the basis for how this works in the Philadelphia model. Is over time, the wholesale fees generate free cash flow for the nonprofit. Those free cash flows are incorporated. This is aside from the working capital reserve, aside from what's required to run the business.
Right.
Those get put into programs like what the PEC has done.
Okay. Now, so the model here is then that building around the provision of broadband services and devices to use them is an effort to essentially bootstrap an entire community, social and economic situation.
Well, there's an economic opportunity in there, too, which I think the private sector sometimes overlooks, and I compare it to prepaid cell cards. I think the first companies that launched prepaid cellular, most of their competitors probably looked at them and thought, you're nuts. What are you doing that for?
Right.
Well, it turns out that prepaid cellular became, a pretty lucrative market because it tapped into a base of potential subscribers that maybe didn't have a credit card or maybe had a bad credit report.
So you're suggesting a similar program of prepaid broadband could
well,
be...
Well, I'm not necessarily suggesting the prepaid thing. I'm really looking at it more from the standpoint of saying, again, is there a market opportunity that exists that private companies, people who sell broadband access and all these other services, is not really an addressable market to them today because, let's say, it's a household where the income's less than, $20,000 a year.
Right.
Well, from a very strategic level, if you're, let's say, a company like Intel or a company that really is critical far back in the value chain, if you look at those kinds of markets, you realize that there's a lot of buying power there, but it's not a market that can be addressed today because of some of these other challenges.
Right. What about this issue? We're obviously not going to address it completely, but I'd like you to just say something about it. Is the goal of eliminating the digital divide to reduce, not to say eliminate, the class divide in the United States, or is it just to create or to prevent the creation of a totally disenfranchised social sector that's completely shut out from the communications network that business and personal life is being conducted on?
Well, I'm not sure I can really talk too much on the macro level social issue. I can say two things. First, I think last year when broadband penetration in the U.S. surpassed 50%
right.
for the first time ever, I think that was a salient event in this issue about digital divide because what it did was maybe it only went from 47% to 50%. That's
right.
An incremental change. But what it did was it sent a message that the disadvantage, the lack of opportunity afforded to those who still remained becomes magnified.
Right.
The closer you move that from 51% to 80% to 90%,
right.
The more of a disadvantage it is to the people who are left on the other side. So I think that's an important issue. And then the other thing is, you have elected officials in major cities who have stakeholders that they are They clearly care about families, children, impoverished, disadvantaged business, and so on. And it isn't as though the shareholders of private industry have necessarily looked at those people as their constituents. You know, as the profit motives versus the social motives. So I really think what you're seeing here is you're seeing broadband step up in terms of how it's viewed and how important it's viewed by those elected officials.
Now, no one seems to disagree with the proposition that education is the key both to individual success and national success of nations. What's the general impact expectation, and what are some of the specific things that are happening in Philadelphia to leverage this network on the educational front from kindergarten to postgraduate as a way of synergizing, multiplying, and making more effective the delivery of educational services to all the people in the city?
Well, I think we worked pretty closely with the school board here in Philadelphia. They were a member, the president was a member of the committee. I think the consistent theme that I saw was that there was a need to reach out and establish better communication between between the school and the home of the child.
Right.
Well, that's very difficult to do. In the absence of having some electronic interface into the home,
right,
and a PC and so on. So I really think that was largely the issue that was looked at. I'm sure that will become more comprehensive.
Has the school institution said that they're going to try to do that with this system?
Well, I think there's an assumption, I don't want to speak for them, I think there's an assumption that by simply making broadband access more affordable at the kind of rates we're talking about will result in more of their students parents and homes and families subscribing to that service, and it becomes something as simple as the school system here has a very robust system for interaction between students and their parents and the teachers. They have all kinds of very innovative systems to do that, but again, until you get a PC in the home of that family and affordable broadband, those tools are not really maximized.
But assuming that does happen, those tools will be able to be maximized.
Sure.
And there'll be a lot of good effects. Traffic congestion and rising gasoline prices. I don't know what the situation is in Philadelphia, but we're just pretty much, they're both sort of increasing exponentially here in Los Angeles. Every day you go out and it's more crowded and the gasoline prices are higher, although you'd think that those two forces would, one of them would negate the other eventually. They're not. What do you see generally, and again specifically in Philadelphia, as the possibilities of a ubiquitous universal broadband wireless network to countervail against traffic congestion and rising gasoline prices?
Well, I think that, this would be, I think, the same in any city. I don't necessarily think it's specific to Philadelphia.
Right.
I think the opportunity for teleworking is, I don't remember the stats here in Philly, but I know a very large number of people commute into the city on a daily basis.
Right.
Increasingly, those people are knowledge workers who, again, don't necessarily have to be at a given facility in the city.
Right.
So I think not only in the city limits, but in the surrounding areas, there's an increasingly critical need, and there's probably a value to be had by allowing and supporting more teleworking.
Not just
broadband. I think, obviously,
right,
that brings in lots of other tools, video applications and new audio conferencing systems and voice over IP and all kinds of things. But
what more could be done from you look at the total systems approach to what you're doing. What more could be done to encourage more telework on the part of the employers, the governments, public consciousness? What do you see as missing to create a groundswell so that people will think it's normal to do their commuting at the same time by working from home?
Well, I don't know. My guess would be some of it's just generational.
Right.
I think leaders in a lot of companies, as you turn over those leaders from one generation to another, I think are increasingly of the view that it's not a disadvantage if you don't have someone stuffed into a cubicle.
Right.
It's actually a great advantage.
This is right out of Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, in which he says that paradigms shift not because people change their mind, but because the
right.
population shifts.
Exactly. Well, so I didn't know it, but I guess I'm a believer in that.
Yes.
I guess the other thing, looking at it from the government standpoint, it's not a specialty of mine, but I would assume that certain programs that might be done at a state level that focus on tax incentives for organizations who have a higher concentration of their workforce. I don't know. That's probably a very controversial thing.
Some kind of a head tax, depending on how many people are at your building, or
sure,
how many people commute to your office space. All right, we're just about wrapping up here, but could you say a little bit about from your perspective of how you see government and even the architecture and structure of cities evolving under the impact of a universal ubiquitous broadband connectivity system?
Well, that's a tall order.
Sort of sketch it out a little bit.
Yeah, well, I mean, this vision that we have for what we call digital cities, I think I've often used the analogy that that the internet has certainly made the world a smaller place, and we've all heard that before. The ability for me to interact with people around the world, not really worrying about time zones, not worrying about place, tool I'm using, those kinds of things, has had a profound impact on me. But when I look at my own community, the city that I live in, the internet really has had very little impact.
That's kind of interesting. In other words, you can deal with people in China, India, Europe, as though they're next.
I get off a video conference with five people in eight different countries,
right,
and then I say, "Honey, I've got to run down to the office,
right,
and stand in line to get my driver's license."
Well, what's the implication of that irony, both for American competitiveness and for the lives of individual people?
Well, I think first of all, part of the cause of it is technology follows mass markets, right? It follows economies of scale.
Right.
The internet has done that, so it's had more of an impact on a global scale, but it has to work its way back into what you might say is your geographic community. My virtual community is great.
Right.
My geographic community is actually a pain.
There's a series of books by William J. Mitchell, who's now head of the media lab at MIT, City of Bits, Etopia, and Me++, in which he talks about how the digital revolution is going to restructure architecture, city planning, mm-hmm, and urban life. What you're talking about now is the need to essentially apply on the local basis the global model of interconnectivity that the internet makes possible.
Right. Well, and the cost of technology coming down is required to do that, because if you don't have billions of users to spread an investment in technology over,
right,
or market a new technology into, then you have to have technology that becomes more affordable. So I think that therein, again, lies unlicensed spectrum, standards-based Wi-Fi and WiMAX.
Okay, well, let's circle it back down again from the global to the local. How is Wireless Philadelphia an attempt to do just this?
Well, I think there's an there's an awareness on the part of the city for what a digital city means and what all of the various benefits are. And I think there's a commitment. Obviously, there's a demonstrated commitment to move in the direction of laying the foundation for that. But these, in my view, this is all the things we're talking about. These are decade-long, sort of things in terms of being able to look back and say, okay, there really was a substantial change.
Okay, in the next two or three years, what do you see the main challenges that you and Civitium and the Wireless Philadelphia Project are going to need to address?
The main challenges?
Right.
Well, I think it's always a challenge to measure the impact of what you said on the front end in terms of what the objectives were and what you were trying to accomplish. It's always very difficult trying to measure social enhancement in a community. You know, what are the metrics?
Right.
Trying to measure economic development. Well, there's so many factors that affect that pinning it down to the impact of one initiative like ubiquitous broadband is very difficult to do. So I think that's always a challenge.
So really, this is only one part of a broader plan. In fact, that's what Mayor Street sees this as, doesn't he?
Well, that's certainly what I've heard from the city and from the mayor, is that sure, there are many, many initiatives. You have to attack the right ones. I think this is viewed as a critical one.
Okay. I want to thank you for talking to us today on Etopia Media's Broadband Wireless Access World, and wish you continued success in Philadelphia and elsewhere. And I hope we'll be able to keep in touch digitally and over other technologies in order to keep our listeners apprised of what all the good work you're doing.
Great. Always a pleasure, Mark.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.